Hi, I'm Stephanie Limick, and this is Building Trauma-Informed Workplaces. I am so excited we have another amazing guest joining us to chat today about something I am very passionate about. And I also think something that is very important when we look at building trauma-informed workplace cultures. We will be talking about supporting veterans in the workplace. And joining us to have that conversation is Matt. Matt, thank you for joining us. I would love if you would introduce yourself to our listeners.
Happy to, Stephanie, and thanks so much for having me. Yeah, my name is Matt Pepsel. I got my first adult job courtesy of the U.S. Marine Corps a long time ago, and I was very pleased to get in. And in my case, I served as an Arabic linguist and a reconnaissance Marine, and had a great time for the 6 years that I was in. And then after that, I went to business school and studied technology and these fun things, and took my first civilian job as a project manager in a software startup, and fell in love with professional development and leading teams, and went on to study psychology of organizations and coaching and leadership, which was so much fun. And currently work for the Predictive Index, which is a workforce assessment company, and still doing the same thing, coaching, leadership, now with a data-informed view. And more recently, wrote a book all about what I call an enlightened leadership approach, born of some of my experiences of both hitting a wall and breaking through that wall when it came to my own meditation practice. And it led me to teach leadership and HR at Boston College. So I've had quite a few dips and turns and twists along the way, but it all started with that military service way back in the day.
I love that. What an amazing career. Such a wealth of experience. And I like most HR professionals, I have taken many different types of assessments, but I love Predictive Index. I'm a maverick. Just to throw out what my Predictive Index results were. But if you haven't had a chance, certainly a whole other conversation around the power of predictive index as a tool and how that can help support trauma-informed workplaces. But we'll save that for another day and focus on veteran experience. When I talk about trauma-informed workplaces, my business is called The Wounded Workforce. A lot of times folks want to talk about veterans, and it makes sense. When we look at statistics, there is information that showcases that veterans are more likely to have experiences of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Numbers show anywhere between 11% and 23% of veterans experience PTSD in a given year, and that is most prevalent between the ages of 18 and 29. Veterans are also 1.5 times more likely to die by suicide than civilian adults, and 17.2 veterans die each day by suicide. So certainly these are statistics that highlight why we want to specifically call out veteran support and why it's so important to consider and think about veterans when we're building trauma-informed workplaces. When we're building workplaces where anyone can be successful, it's also really important because there's a lot of benefits for workplaces on transitioning veterans, transitioning military individuals into the workplace. There is a ton of benefits that can be realized as well. And we're going to talk about it a little bit later in the podcast. Some of that transition goes really well. Some employers are doing a great job, some not so much. So really a lot of interesting items to talk about. And of course, my father is a disabled veteran. My uncle retired from the United States Navy. I am a big believer in when, folks or service members complete their service, it is our responsibility to continue to show up and support them, pa past, just saying thank you, but really doing that with action. Before we dive too deep into our conversation, I do want to get a few things out of the way. And just make sure we're all thinking about things as clearly as possible. And a few of those things are, not every veteran or service member has experienced trauma, or has experienced trauma related to their service. And of course, they don't all have PTSD. Traumatic experiences can have long-term effects without an official diagnosis of PTSD as well. So when we talk about trauma in the workplace, when we talk about the impacts of trauma on veterans, we're not only specifically looking at the impacts or diagnosis of PTSD. This one is one I'm sure we all know, but veterans are not the only demographic that experience trauma that may have its effects show up in the workplace. And last but certainly not least, as we know, the trauma-informed workplaces are designed to support everyone, regardless of their trauma status. This applies for veterans too. So regardless of their trauma status, we want to make sure that we're leveraging the principles of trauma-informed workplaces to really build secure, supportive environments and help everyone be successful. So I will get off my soapbox. I know y'all are always tired of hearing me get on my soapbox. And let's hear from our expert we have on board. And I'm so excited to have a veteran joining us for this important conversation. I love when we have someone with lived experience. You know, you started your career in the Marines and then you transitioned to a very robust and really interesting career. I'd love to hear more about, you know, your experience in the military and then maybe even, you know, a little bit about that experience of transitioning as well.
Yeah, it was from the time that I was, I would say in fifth grade, I kind of knew that I wanted to be part of the Marines. And if you asked me at the time, like, why, I don't know, I didn't know that much about the military at all, but from what I had heard, they were the toughest. So that's what I wanted to do. And by the time I joined, you know, I went through boot camp and got into my fleet assignment. And I said, well, okay, I'm here. Like, what's the toughest thing we can do here? And they said, well, recon's the toughest. I said, I'll do that. I don't know. I must've been one of those classic young men with something to prove. But I was honored to go in. I was really happy to serve. But if I'm being 100% honest, I also had, you know, gone down a path in my life where I had enrolled in college, but it was straight out of high school. I wasn't ready, wasn't mature enough. I was in an ROTC program, so I still had that Marine Corps sort of connection, but the college stuff was just not a great fit for me at that time. And so when I turned in a 0.7 GPA, the school said, don't hurry back. And I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, I really like the military part of that experience in ROTC, but I just didn't like college stuff right now. So I went and enlisted. And when I showed up, they said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I know I love languages, so I'd like to be a linguist. And they said, well, if you commit to 6 years, you can, you know, more or less be guaranteed to have that MOS. That specialty and that job assignment. So that's what I did. And I was very pleased to be assigned. My first real school assignment was out in Monterey, California at the Defense Language Institute, where they taught me Arabic, which was lovely. Carried on to San Angelo, Texas, which is where Goodfellow Air Force Base is, to learn code breaking. And then got my fleet assignment out in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And that's where I got assigned to the recon teams and was able to learn how to jump out of airplanes and go to all these fun things. So It was a great time for a young person really to feel that sense of service, that pride, hard work, learn about esprit de corps, certainly leadership from day one, and really have a very positive first few years of my enlistment.
That's incredible. Wow. I mean, you learned both Arabic and code breaking and then how to jump out of planes.
Yeah.
Like, what a range.
It's quite a range. Yeah, the first two are pretty common in the sense that we sent a lot of service members through, and as part of the MOS, the military occupational specialty known as signals intelligence, it's part of the intelligence community, and that's something that we do quite a bit of. And so at the time when I was in, I'm not sure how it is now, but Marines would be taught either Spanish, Korean, Russian, or Arabic. And I thought, well, I've studied Russian college. I'm sure they're going to want to put me in a Russian program. They're like, no, Arabic. I was like, well, okay. I guess we'll just do what they say. Yeah.
That's awesome. How interesting. So, I mean, what was that? So I guess let's ask a really basic question. You know, maybe some of our listeners don't know, but what is recon? What is the responsibility or what types of things were you doing, you know, doing recon as a Marine?
Yeah, when you think about collecting intelligence, generally speaking, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You know, today we can use satellites and we can take pictures and learn a lot that way. And then the ships can collect a lot of information at those ultra high frequencies and ship to ship kind of communication. And then when you get onto the shore, you've got vehicles that can pick up certain amount and Humvees that can get pretty close to the action. But when you want to be right next door, you need to send in recon teams. And so the chance to be as close as you can to where the action is, listening to radios, watching, you know, there's different types of reconnaissance that take place. And it's really just a chance to be contribute, I would say, to that overall understanding of a given situation, whether it's, you know, as large as a battlefield or something smaller. And that was what the training really entailed. So a lot of it was really coming down to using language skills and other types of cryptography skills and other types of collection skills, I would say. And then you just take all your intelligence and you send it, you know, up the chain, so to speak, so they can assemble the clearest picture they can about what's going on. And so for the Marines in the time when I was in, we would either go to one of two primary duty stations. One was out in Hawaii, out in Kaneohe Bay. And the other was, as I mentioned, in Camp Lejeune, where I ended up. So what's kind of funny is I met my bride, she was serving as a Marine too. She was a Spanish linguist and I was an Arabic linguist. And it would be several years before we would connect and get married. But she had a similar experience in the sense of going through those first two programs of learning a language and going to cryptography school. So we were assigned together in DLI in Monterey, assigned together again, and then again in Camp Lejeune. So it's
a very common path. Wow, for interesting.
Yeah, it was fun. And I'll tell you this, Stephanie, one of us stayed tough. I'll let you guess which one it was after we got out. Spoiler alert, it wasn't me.
I was going to guess, you know, but yeah. I'm sure you're pretty tough. I can tell. It's all good. So that's incredible. You know, I appreciate you sharing a little bit more about your military experience. It's so interesting too, because I think, you know, while there are many things that translate well to kind of the corporate world, there are a lot of things that don't translate well also 100%. When it comes to, you know, military service, military background, and the corporate world, and how, you know, getting better at translating those things can really be helpful. So appreciate some of the storytelling there. I'd love to, if you're comfortable, you know, reflect back to that transition for you, transitioning from, you know, those 6 years in the Marines, doing really interesting, very technical stuff, to then, you know, transitioning back to, being a service member, back to, you know, corporate America, education, those different things. What was that like? You know, what stands out from what you remember in that moment?
Yeah, Stephanie, it was almost probably the tale of two halves of my enlistment. So I mentioned I did 6 years. The first three, I didn't really think too much because I still had 3 years left on my enlistment. I didn't think too much about anything other than being a Marine at the time. And I was going through so much schooling and trying to get myself qualified to be on those recon teams. When we did our first deployment, it was to Somalia back in the day. And so I was on the ground in Somalia in Mogadishu and being part of the local Marine Expeditionary Unit there. And that was a fabulous learning experience and just overall life experience. And then reported back home and then was home for about a week before they stood up our MEU again. And we ended up going down to Haiti. And we didn't go ashore in Haiti, but we were sort of force in readiness there. And then my second deployment ended off the coast of Bosnia. This was around the same time as Scott O'Grady, the downed Air Force captain, had to be rescued. And so those were two deployments, 6 months apiece on the Navy ships. And you have a lot of time to think. And by the time the second deployment happened, I was already married and I was an enlisted Marine. And I was thinking I could either stay in and probably switch over to become an officer. But I kind of felt like I was so proud to go in, but I was really looking forward to transitioning to civilian life and having a chance to have a little bit more say so over, you know, whatever it is I would do next. So what that means, Stephanie, is that I had this notion that I'm about to become a 27-year-old freshman because after a 6-year enlistment, after a year of failed college, that was going to be a problem for me. So I made this decision that I needed to catch up with life. So I took advantage of everything that the military had to offer in terms of testing out of programs, taking classes on the ship and the shore, just to get my academic credentials caught up. And I found a program that allowed me to combine all that experience and all that testing and that coursework into an accredited degree. And I ended up getting my bachelor's degree the same month that I separated from the Marine Corps. So it was down to the wire, but I basically caught up with life, I felt.
That's incredible. I think that's an interesting challenge and an interesting dynamic to think about navigating is, you know, thinking about all the experience you had at 27, as opposed to someone, you know, 22, 23, fresh out of a degree program. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, unfortunately, you know, especially, you know, a decade ago, when we're looking at resumes, when we're looking at backgrounds of individuals for employment, we're kind of looking at the degree as kind of that, you know, okay, yes, let's move it. Here's this barrier. And I think really discounting all of the incredible experience that comes with 4 years, 6 years of military service. And I think one thing I've seen a lot of organizations get better with, a lot of leaders get better with, is number one, let's really be critical about whether or not a degree is truly required. And then also, let's also be really thoughtful about, hey, how does all of this great experience, life experience, military experience really translate to the work that we want this person to be doing? That's incredible. I love that you found the resources to kind of combine that military experience and, you know, feel caught up and have that degree program. Do you feel like that was, I mean, that sounds like it was hard to kind of get that all ticked off.
Yeah, it was a choice, right? So it was a choice of, do I want to go out drinking with my friends or do I want to hit the books? And one would have been more fun, but one was necessary for me to kind of get caught up. Now, at the same time, there was these two paths I could have gone down. While I was in, I was injured. And so I was actually put out of the military with a service-connected disability because of the injury that I sustained. And I wouldn't say it was a traumatic injury. It was an injury that just happened. But at the same time, what that meant is that I had two paths. One was to just separate and do the transition and take a civilian job, whatever I could line up. And I'll start by saying that at the time, the translation of those skills, I certainly didn't do a great job. I didn't know how to translate all of the experiences I had to make myself an appealing candidate. And I would say at that time, the military didn't do a great job of helping me either. So my options were really limited. I was disappointed with what the civilian world was saying back to me. These are opportunities for you, the nature of those jobs. And in fact, the best job that I was offered was an assistant manager job at a muffler shop. And there's no disrespect there whatsoever, other than to say I have no mechanical bone in my body. No, it's a terrible fit, terrible. And I thought, I cannot imagine that I would be happy in that. But that was one where they thought, okay, well, you've had some supervisory skills and, you know, some technical ability probably. So here you go. And I thought, okay, so that's door number one. Great. Let's keep looking. And because of the nature of my disability, then I qualified for a program known as vocational rehabilitation, which meant that there's a certain amount of rehabilitation and accommodation and investment they were willing to make me ready to transition back into civilian service. And for me, that meant being able to go to school at Boston University. So that was the path that I took. And in the experience of that aftermath, what I found is that graduate school was exceptionally easy, having been a military member, because where some of the other my classmates, you know, had only been civilians their whole life, you know, they were struggling with either the coursework or they were dating. And I'm like, okay, I've been married for a couple of years, even though I'm 27, and coursework, you think that's hard? Like, try staying up for 4 days straight out in the field, you know, with a 50-pound ruck and, you know, all these kinds of things. So I found that the discipline, the approach that we had taken in the military, the level of rigor, commitment required, it made civilian life in that structured environment really easy by comparison. And I noticed that. And I thought, man, the military really primed me for success in that regard. What was different is when I entered the civilian work ranks, though, and there wasn't the same level of structure, and it opened up, I thought, oh, I wasn't built for this. I've only ever known how to perform and be a high performer within a structure. When you remove all of that sort of scaffolding, that's not necessarily something they teach you as an enlisted person how to do in the military as well. So that was interesting. Yeah,
that's the number one thing I think about when it comes to an effective transition. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many reasons folks recruit from pools of veterans, because there are so many amazing skills and free training they've received, leadership capacity, that, like what you're talking about, that resilience, that grit, you're ready to, you know, hit the books. You're not, you know, you're familiar with that structure. And so there's so much organizations are like, yes, let me take advantage of this individual's already knowledge, skills, abilities, but also this cultural, you know, hardworking, resilient personality. And then go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I think that's true in a lot of industries in particular, things like manufacturing, certainly defense contracting, where there's that appreciation. But I wouldn't say it's universal. Not every organization knows and appreciates sort of how a military life can really prepare you for success in a more traditional professional capacity. And what I find is that if you don't have any veterans on staff and you're going to hire the first veteran, sometimes that's such a like, is it really something that we want to do? How do we really relate to this person? And I would say that in all the civilian jobs I've ever held, there has been a very significant minority of people who have any amount of military service, like single digit.
You know, I love that you made this point, Matt, because it is, it's very true. There are some industries that are very good at military recruiting, veteran recruiting. I spent a lot of time in the construction industry. So I think about construction, for example, does a fantastic job. Yes. But to your point, yes, there are a lot of organizations missing out. And I love that you brought this up because I think a lot of the organizations, you know, I'd say like tech, a lot of the, you know, so-called, you know, desk jobs or remote work jobs, hybrid jobs, probably aren't doing the best at translating.
Thinking about retail, hospitality, things that, you know, it's harder to translate those things. You're like, I want a job at CVS. What did you do to prepare you for this job? I was a machine gunner. They're like, oh, well, what am I supposed to do with that? You know, so if somebody doesn't do the translation, either the employer who has the experience of interpreting or the military person who now knows how to express themselves in that sort of way and make those connections of, well, I'm dependable and I'm reliable and I'm detail oriented and I'm structured in my approach and I'm process driven, like all those things. Then it's like, well, then there's we're kind of talking past one another. And then it's just the stigma of being different. So to your point about construction, yes, but also extremely large companies. They may have employee resource groups full of veterans that they're connecting across their business, like an AT&T or whatever. That's another area where you see a lot of comfort hiring veterans, a lot of experience. But a small to mid-sized, you know, software company or a reasonable size retail restaurant chain, not necessarily.
This is such a good point, because as soon as we started talking about this and, you know, like you said, you've experienced single digits, you know, veterans. And I've worked in small organizations where there was maybe one or two veterans working, and it becomes so easy to not consider it. And then when you're working in a big organization and there is this really strong plan and thought process around recruiting and inclusion. I know I spoke to someone who transitioned and, you know, was working with Home Depot. And I hear Home Depot has a phenomenal transition program and support. Again, we're looking at really big organizations.
Definitely.
And the employee resource groups, because military service veteran, that background is an aspect of diversity. It may not be an aspect of diversity that we're thinking of right away. But I also think some of those less visible aspects of diversity are really powerful. And when organizations unlock that and support those kind of hidden aspects of diversity, that's really where we get to truly inclusive, supportive environments. When we're like, oh, we're being thoughtful about how we're including recruiting veterans, including veterans in our culture and how things work. Think about that in the way you are thinking about other aspects of diversity if you're a small or mid-sized organization, and it may help you kind of reframe the approach. And then also, like you said, Matt, how can you help translate some of those skills? And one thing that is fantastic is there are a lot more resources, including resources from the government, on translating skills from the military to, you know, civilian work, which 100%. Is really helpful.
Yeah, a lot of new crosswalks are available to kind of translate MOS skills and military skills to their civilian equivalents. The other thing I think that I didn't really appreciate is, in terms of diversity and inclusion, these are things that fuel creativity and innovation, which is something that almost every organization these days wants. And I think that when you think about how veterans adapt to change, you know, because it's a constantly volatile environment that we're in. And so it's really ingrained into us. I think that's a real asset. And at the same time, you know, a lot of times what I found is when I got into the civilian ranks, we'd be talking about things like planning processes. And I'm like, well, you know, we have pretty good planning processes in the military. And they're like, oh yeah, like what? I'm like, well, we could put a well-equipped and well-armed group of Marines anywhere on the planet within less than 48 hours. And they're like, okay, that's pretty impressive. Yeah. Yes. You have to be good at that. So it's like, you can bring in certain things that work for you. You have to translate them and kind of skinny them down a little bit, but there's absolutely things that I took for granted about my military service. And one of the chief among them was mission and purpose. Like if you enlist in the Marine Corps, in my example, you're committed to national service and, you know, being a part of something. When you go work at a local restaurant chain, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, where's that purpose coming from? You have to manufacture that as the leader of your team, yeah, your shift, whatever. So it's like, it doesn't just come out of the box the way that it did when we were in the service. And that was a big learning lesson for me too, is like, I thought everybody would just carry and comport themselves with a similar, like, you know, here's why we're here type thing. No, you had to manufacture that. And I'm like, wow, this is different.
That is different. That is different. I think it's especially interesting. So often HR professionals, we're talking about recruiting veterans. When we talk about veteran populations, we're talking about recruiting, we're talking about transition. But you've brought up a couple of things in our conversation, talking about your own experience in a transition from military service to civilian life, yeah, organizational structure, mm-hmm, and then also mission and purpose. And to me, those are really big deal cultural aspects that I would hope, you know, company leadership, HR leadership are talking about when we think about, okay, how do we navigate and how do we integrate veterans into, mm-hmm, our organizational structure? Number one, that more likely than not is going to be pretty different than the military. And then two, is our mission and purpose clear and compelling? Which even if you're not recruiting veterans or don't have veterans on your team, that's a pretty important one anyway, but it becomes even more important based on that, yeah, purpose-driven work you referenced. I'm interested, especially, you know, your experience around navigating, I'm going to be a nerd, navigating the organizational structure, mm-hmm, the differences there, because to me, organizational structures are such an interesting conduit of power in an organization. And when we talk about trauma-informed workplaces, you know, talking about power, where it lives, how we manage it is really important. So I'm super interested to, you know, what your impression was and how you kind of navigated such a big difference.
Yeah, in my case, you know, I think one thing we want to point out is that we talk about military people as if it's like a very broad brush. Yes. And the reality is that different military jobs, different parts, and even different times of military service can be experienced quite differently by veterans. And so as an example, the teams that I worked with were six person, and in the time that I was in, they were six man teams working on doing collecting intelligence. So there's not a lot of hierarchy there. There's clearly somebody who's the most senior person who's running the team leader. But beyond that, it's kind of like, you know, a lot of us are just kind of in it together, regardless of rank. Some of that stuff kind of falls away. And there's a lot of this work that's been done since around teams of teams, you know, General McChrystal and these types of things. So some parts of the military are much more equivalent to these network type organizational structures where hierarchy matters less than the efficient flow of information and decision making. Other parts of the military, though, are very hierarchical and very much lean on the infrastructure of rank and policy and procedure to accomplish their mission. All that means is that in the civilian world, the same can be true. Very, very large organizations tend to be more hierarchical, for example, for better or for worse, than like small growth stage companies, which tend to be more flatter network. They may have an org chart that looks a certain way, but it doesn't really depict how things get done. People have pockets of influence or, you know, how these things work. So for me, long way of saying that, for me to go from a more entrepreneurial type flat team structure in the military was an easy transition to a startup that had fewer than 40 people in the technology space that was effectively flatter by comparison. So it was a natural transition. However, when that company got bought by a mega company and started to impose the same hierarchical, rigid control that I experienced to some degree when I was in the service, I said, I got to get out of here. Because it was the same poor fit as the parts of the military that I didn't like so much, yeah, that led me to separate in the first place. So long way of saying that organizational structures absolutely matter, that people may experience different versions of that depending on their military assignment. And we just need to understand, is there a translation that needs to happen here? Or is this person going from hierarchy to hierarchy or network to network or something that crosses a little bit where there's going to be an adjustment period required?
I love it. I think it's so thoughtful and it really sums up, you know, I said it around, hey, we don't want to assume that veterans have experienced trauma. We want to recognize the statistics. We don't want to assume. I think it gets to the same thing that, you know, you're speaking to, Matt, is there is such a breadth of experience and different skill sets and different roles and different types of organizations existing within our military, especially today. We don't want to assume. Because it's easy to jump to the assumption, oh, you're used to a really hierarchical structure, so you'll do better in one. And you just told us about why you don't typically prefer one. And I think it's one of those things probably we should get better at asking everyone, you know, maybe not in my nerdy or theory and design way, but in a way that better understands how do you prefer to work with in team structures, within, you know, different power dynamics in a team, and what have you done before, what has worked well and what hasn't, because all organizations kind of have those different structures, different dynamics, including different ones existing in the military. So I think that's an incredible insight. I really appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah, I've tried to pay attention because I feel like there's things that I've learned and observed that do apply. And I think that was my favorite thing about the military. I will say that although I've been in the minority of being a former military person, a veteran inside of all of my civilian jobs, I've really been treated with one of two sort of attitudes most. One is, I can't relate, which is fine, understandable. The other is, you know, I'm proud of that you did that. You know, thanks for doing that. Just general appreciation, I would say, for having, you know, signed on the line and showed up and did that type of service, which is nice. But I think the most powerful is to say, what did you learn there that might apply here? What did you learn that might help us as an example? And I think that's the sort of the next level for when we do bring veterans or really anybody into our organization. When we're talking about diversity and inclusion, it's not just, oh, isn't it great that we accommodate you and you don't feel, you know, like an only or that you're threatened? Okay, yeah, that's kind of the low bar, but sure. What is it about your perspective that's different than ours that you might be able to bring to this consideration, right? So as an example, if you have a company that provides products or services to very young people and you don't have very many young people who work for your company, maybe you should, because they're a lot closer to your customer than you are at this point. So understanding, saying like, help us be a translator. What are you seeing? That's, if you didn't take advantage of that, what a waste that would be. So I feel like the veteran thing is definitely like, let's bring them in. Let's make sure that they're having a successful transition, but let's also tap into the unique value that they've seen some things that nobody else on the planet has. They've gone through and had some experiences that could potentially unlock a next level of value for us. Not just say you're here and you feel welcome, like that's just table stakes.
I love that. I think that's so perfect. I think that's that when you're doing that, when you're leveraging talent in your organization that way, that is when you are really creating a true differentiator. You're using people as a true differentiator in your business. So I think that's fantastic. I'm curious now if you've had an experience where you felt like you really got that ask, where your team, your organization really leveraged that unique experience that you brought with you.
From time to time, it's happened, you know, where especially around, like I mentioned, planning cycles a little bit earlier, the way that communication can happen, the nature of the way if we do training, as an example. There's so much, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the transition, and I mentioned some things that went pretty well. One thing that absolutely did not go well was the fact that I was exposed to so much leadership development in the military and almost none of it when I got to civilian life. And as a young early career person, I was sitting here thinking, we invest so heavily in leadership development because if you need a new general in the Marine Corps, you can't just go to Indeed and hire somebody from off the street. You've got to develop from within. So no wonder we spend so much time in the nature of what it is that we do focused on leadership development. But when I got to the civilian world and I said, yeah, I just really feel like I'm just beginning my leadership journey. I'd like to take the next step. Like, what kind of leadership training options do we have here? They're like, what are you talking about? What a missed opportunity that was. So when I started to bring in sort of that perspective, a lot of times then the HR teams would ask me, well, how did you approach this when you were in the military? How did you approach, you know, learning at scale or quickly or just in time, or, you know, what sort of techniques worked? You know, if we talk about something like school circle, and they're like, well, what's that? What's the school circle? Oh, it's just, you know, you're out in the field, you have nothing, you got no, and you just say, form a school circle around me. Let's go tight, get tight on me here. You know, we use our own language. People are like, okay. And then all of a sudden we're exchanging stories and having some of the more senior Marines talk about and provide some level of education with clear learning objectives. They're like, this is amazing. You all do this all the time. And like, yeah, we had to. We're on the ship, we're on the shore, we're in the woods. Like, we got to, the learning doesn't stop. And they're like, well, what would that look like here? Right. Now, all of a sudden, I'm working collaboratively with L&D professionals to say, well, you know, we could do some of this type of stuff. And those were some of my favorite translation moments, if you will.
That's incredible. Yeah. I mean, what a great way to really translate. Yeah, so much of, you know, L&D HR professionals, we talk about the ROI or seeing the impact or translating training into our day to day. I mean, you describe a school circle. I'm like, wow, that's.
Yeah,
it's so simple, and it can be so impactful. Yeah. And I think sometimes those are the most elegant solutions. We make very difficult and very complex solutions to problems. And sometimes the easiest, the quickest, the let's get together and figure this out.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's the best. I love that. That's very cool.
When I first got out, I would post on my office walls some of the examples that we would use from the Marines. I would put up our, in our case, we had the 14 leadership traits, you know, justice, judgment, decisiveness, all these things. And then also different Marine leadership principles. So one, for example, was train your Marines as a team. And so then I left it reading like that, which people would look at it and be like, okay, you know, this guy's, it wasn't like trying to be a hard charger. It was trying to say what from these lessons might help us here. And people would come up to my office and they'd be reading them. They'd look and they'd be like, what's training Marines a team? Like, how did that work? And how might that work here? So all of a sudden they were pulling out of me those examples. And I was like, well, for us, we're a software product team, for example, like what type of training do we agree that we all need? And it might be something around, who knows, user feedback or something. Like, well, rather than send one person to go to user feedback, what if we all did it together as a team? Like, so it was just a way to kind of make visible some of what I had been exposed to so that my team at the time would come and say, okay, now we understand where you came from, you weirdo. But also like, hey, some of that stuff is pretty intriguing. What if, how would that look here? And can we replicate in a tiny, tiny way, you know, some of that?
I'd love to, because one thing I frequently, you know, dig in on, especially when I'm working with individuals I coach or teams I coach, I'm very focused on curiosity and how powerful curiosity, asking open-ended questions without judgment, how much that can do for you as an individual, but also overall for the team. So I love, you know, you were sparking that curiosity and there's that openness around asking questions. And that was really the catalyst for translating so much of what you already knew and what you'd learned into your workplace. So cool. I'm over here like, I gotta download these 14 principles. I love the train your Marines as a team, because it is, it's so true. So often we're like, oh, let's see what we have budget for. We'll send Jim, and then he'll come back with takeaways and just the dynamic that creates. And then what are we really learning together versus, well, Jim learned something and now he'll sort of pass it along, but what's actually happening there? So I think
the military is often out in front of the civilian world in many cases too, because I remember even when I was going through and they would say things like aim for the 70% solution, because by the time you're on the battlefield and you're waiting for perfect information, your opportunity has passed. And so even back then we were talking about, you know, how much information is, if you only have 50%, you're probably not done yet. But if you aim for more than 70, you're probably taking too long. No more analysis paralysis. We got to make a decision and go, even though the stakes in the military are obviously much, much higher than in, you know, in my case, in a software company. But the mentality, though, is something that over the next decade, they ended up catching up to with these like agile programming methodologies and how do you experiment and test and then do all these things. And I'm like, yeah, where have you been? It's like, we've known about this stuff for a long time because we had to. And so I just think it's a way, again, of taking advantage of having military people on your team, is that in many cases, they've been exposed to techniques and different sort of structures and different sort of methodologies that were created by necessity under the most extreme conditions, you know, that the human condition can know, that eventually are going to show up in the civilian world anyway. And I don't think it's a surprise that a lot of military terms end up making their way into civilian ranks. You know, when the sales team needs air cover, or it's a VUCA environment and all this stuff, you're like, hey, man, we invented that stuff. What are you doing? You're just appropriating our culture over here.
We're translating it, okay? Yes, we've hired some amazing veterans and we're translating it. No, I love that. I think that's so great. One thing, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Sure. But, you know, we talk about mission and purpose and how that's so important, especially when we see folks typically transitioning from a very mission and purpose driven organization, you know, in the military. And that may be more consistent than, for example, organizational structure expectations. What are some things that, you know, leaders can think about, you know, when they think about communicating mission and purpose and making sure it's impactful for everyone, but certainly when we're thinking about folks coming from the military, coming from, you know, a big focus on mission and purpose, which lots of younger generations are also very focused on this. So this, I would say, has an impact across quite a few demographics in the workplace.
Yeah, 100%. You're exactly right, Stephanie. It's so true. And I think that when I think about if I'm an employer and I want to attract military people and help them with that transition, be explicit about that mission, you know, what it is that we do. Don't take for granted the fact that they understand completely the impact that they're going to have, the higher ideal. This is a group of people in the military who have been in pursuit of national service, you know, and national security for a long time. So it's a matter of saying, like, here's why the work we do matters. You may know it as the CEO, but if it's not more than just in your brain or, you know, on the walls of your break room, if it's not just dripping off of everything you do, then you have to do the work to meet them there to help them understand that. That's one thing. The second is I do think that there's an ability to articulate it, but also to share it even with your stakeholders, not even just internally. And I'll give you a real quick example. I'm here on Cape Cod and they just opened a new Whole Foods, bigger than the last one. I couldn't wait this weekend to go to Whole Foods and see what it was like. It's, you know, just giant space. But my bride is looking at me and she's like, are you coming? Like, what are you doing? And I'm looking above the, it must've been like the dairy cabin or something. They've got their core values and it's their belief statements. You know, we believe and we shop local and we do this and we invest Amazon's proceeds wisely. Like, you know, we're about profits and people, like all these kinds of things. They're not putting that there for the employees who walk by. They're putting it there for their customers and saying, like, we're about something. So if the place where I go get my overpriced milk and eggs, right, kids can get it right, then we can all get it right. All it takes is a little bit of the time to go offline and figure out, like, have we articulated our mission, our values, what I like to say is our collective belief statements, and are we being transparent and making these visible, not just to our employees, but also to our customers or consumers, also to our communities, to anybody who we happen to have the good grace, you know, to touch. And I think the military people would be like, oh, that I recognize, that I understand. Like, that's a good way to create that connection for sure.
I love that. I think too, I mean, I shop certain places because of, you know, the values they're putting forward, the beliefs, like you're saying. So I think so powerful and to be thoughtful about that connection. I do love the calling out your beliefs is what we believe. It's really powerful.
It's powerful. And now it's necessary. If you want to retain your competitive advantage, you're going to want to have access to top talent. And to the point you were just making, early career people, young people, even post-pandemic workers are like, I don't want to just show up for a paycheck anymore. I want to make sure that if I'm expending my life energy, that I'm making a difference to something I care about, which could be the planet. It could be society. It could be my local community. It could be the customers themselves. You could work at a dry cleaner and say, hey, you know what? Some people who bring in their stuff, they're trying to you know, get their suits clean so they can have a successful job interview so they can put food on the table for their family. Like, if that's what you're into is people having clean clothes, then be all about that and don't be shy about that. Right. And you know, everything from, I'm thinking about dentist, ice cream, but it doesn't matter. Like, what, if you're passionate about what you do and you can see a benefit bigger than your own bottom line, that single agenda, then don't be surprised when you put it out there. Some, you know, veterans who that resonates with is going to be like, I have something similar. It's not the same as national security, you know, to clean people's suits, but at the same time, it's similar in the sense that it's a something bigger than oneself. And that's what young people, post-pandemic people, veterans tend to look for.
That's fantastic. Amazing. Such amazing insights. I want to be, you know, respectful of your time. So, you know, quickly for folks who are listening in, who are maybe a transitioning veteran or know someone who is a transitioning veteran, do you have any quick advice for them as they explore that, you know, move from the military to civilian life?
Yeah, I think go in with the same level of awareness that we've always had in the military, recognize your value, and do the hard work of translating, at least try to meet people halfway. You've got to take the first step of interpreting and translating the value that you provide within terms that they'll recognize. Now, hopefully you'll have some help doing that. You know, as Stephanie mentioned, there's more services than ever. Some organizations are better at it than others in helping sort of meet you halfway, but you can't assume that's always going to happen. So recognize that the fact that you went through what you went through as a veteran, you know, really means that you have a lot of value to offer to organizations, but they may not understand it because they just don't have the experience of looking at it. So you have to help them see it. And once they do, I think, you know, being patient with yourself when it comes to making that transition and recognizing that it takes time because it is different. You know, I had a relatively easy transition, but I still struggled at times. It was hard to, you know, be in a very different environment that was so free of structure, and, you know, certain things that I took for granted just weren't there. I didn't have the same scaffolding. So be patient with yourself, and it gets easier day by day. And certainly ask for help if you need it. There's a lot more sources of help than there have ever been.
I love that. And then quickly for, you know, an HR leader, a leader listening in on this podcast, they want to get better at supporting veterans, whether that's in the recruiting process, whether that's, you know, veterans already on their team. Do you have any, you know, quick advice or things they can incorporate into their day-to-day to be a more supportive partner?
Yeah, I think the Veterans Administration has great information coming out of it. There's also organizations like the Recon Network that helps transitioning veterans. I've worked with Squared Away, which hires military spouses, which is another underserved population that's tangential to the veteran themselves in some cases, but struggle to find durable employment because of all the frequent moves and other unique challenges in the military. So there's just so many great organizations that are helping to, you know, sort of bridge that gap towards solving these scourges of homelessness and substance abuse and undereducation and joblessness that really are a blight on the record of these veterans who've really dedicated a good chunk of their lives to support our way of life. So I think there's a lot of great organizations out there. I'm sure they'd be happy to help.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And Matt, obviously you mentioned you have a book, you have a podcast, you have a ton of stuff that you put out. Where can folks find you and listen in and learn more from you and, you know, follow the work that you're doing?
Yeah, thanks so much. The book is called Expand the Circle, which is a leadership book. And the podcast is called Lead the People. And it's very much a weekly show where I get a chance to interview some really fascinating people. Easiest place to follow me is on mattpepsel.com. It's my personal web address. But I'm most highly active on LinkedIn. I love to connect with people on LinkedIn, just the way you and I connected to, Stephanie. And it's the easiest place to get a hold of me is on LinkedIn.
Amazing. And in the show notes, I have linked the book, the podcast, Matt's LinkedIn, and his website. So definitely make sure if you are not following along, you go ahead and follow his amazing work. Matt, I am so grateful that you came on, you shared your own experience. It really helps us just be more thoughtful about how we can support veterans and how we can continue to do better. I really appreciate it. Everyone, thank you so much for listening in, and until next time, be well.